And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, September the 15th, 2016. 12:16 coming up on 12:17 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you are tuned into the Now program. And we have got a great show today. We have an author on this first hour who's going to talk about a great book that's got a neat tie-in with somebody who we knew very well. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But did want to let you know that next hour we're going to be joined by Representative Ted Deutsch from Florida, who's going to be discussing the current political campaign. So you won't want to miss that. 15 minutes, 1:15 today, and then we're going to have an open phone lines for the last half hour from 1:30 until 2 o'clock. So you won't want to miss that. But we do want to start off this hour. This will be political as well, because we're going to talk about a new book, which I just got in the mail yesterday and read last night. It is a great read, The Conservative Case for Trump. The authors of this are Ed Martin, Brett M. Decker, and the late Phyllis Schlafly. And as everybody knows, Phyllis Schlafly just passed away at age 92 last Monday, Labor Day, I guess it was. And Phyllis, of course, was on this show many times. We met and did an interview up at the Republican Convention on July the 19th, and we miss Phyllis very much, but this is her last book. And I'll tell you a little backstory, just a side backstory here. I knew this book was coming out, and we had talked to Phyllis about doing an interview, and she was supposed to come on. She had been on July 19th, and then she came on again on August 2nd, I believe it was. And we were trying to set up an interview to talk about this book. And the first time we tried to set it up with Phyllis in late August, she had a meeting. And then the next week, she had gotten laryngitis. And then the following week, we were all shocked to find out that she had passed away. But luckily today, we are joined by one of the other authors of this book, Ed Martin, who is, by all accounts, my understanding, Phyllis Schlafly's hand-picked successor for the Eagle Forum, which is what Mrs. Schlafly headed up. So we are very glad to welcome to these microphones Ed Martin. Ed, how are you?
Thank you. That was what a nice story too about Phyllis. She loved doing radio. She loved being out and talking to folks, and she enjoyed your show. And I knew when it was on the schedule that one week that you mentioned, she got kind of a respiratory infection and kind of slowed down. And it's hard for me to believe that such a lady is not with us. I keep thinking she'll walk in. My office is next to hers, and I keep thinking she'll walk in and explain something to me or tell me something to do, and it is a sadness. On the other hand, only Phyllis Schlafly could go out with her boots on. You know, she was at the convention, and as you mentioned, as a delegate, she'd been to every convention since 1952. Here she was, and she loved every minute of it. I'll tell you, you'll love this. One night I said to her, you know, you don't have to go back to the convention. Tonight's a kind of slow night. It wasn't a nomination. It wasn't a big speech. And I said, you know, you could take the night off. And she was 92, 91 and a half. Why would I do that? I'm a delegate. You know, I'm going to go. And she was there until the balloons fell. And then, of course, this book, which we raced to finish in April and May, and we were getting ready to publish it. The date got slid around, and we finally put it out. And lo and behold, she passes away the day before, which is a publicist's nightmare. On the other hand, the whole world looked up and said, Phyllis died. Oh, and she wrote a book. And so here we are in the book, by the way, we just found out last night, is debuting at number 16 on the New York Times bestseller list. So we're going out in style, and we're contributing to the debate about the important things in this country.
Absolutely. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about Phyllis, because it was so heavy the last few months. I could not have been more shocked, because I sat with her at the Republican convention, as a matter of fact, and we did a tribute to Phyllis the day after she died. Her son, Andy, very nicely came on the program. And I cannot tell you the shock, because, yes, she was 91 and a half, and, yes, walking around the Quicken Loans Arena was not something any 90-year-old would do. So she was in a wheelchair when I saw her, but she was dressed so beautifully. She was, mind was totally there, did not look sick, and for most accounts was not. And she had to come up to a hallway where we were. She was on the floor. That was the night
Chris Christie spoke. I believe it was Tuesday. Tuesday was July 19th. And her son, Andy, who was with her, had to bring her from the floor because that was the day they were pledging the delegates. Our show went on at 7 o'clock that night. She wanted to be on because she'd been on via telephone before. She was on the floor, wanted to get her pledge in, and those hallways were packed by 7 o'clock. She got in the elevator with her son in a wheelchair, came upstairs, and did the interview and took pictures with everybody up there. And the neat thing was we were upstairs across from catering where the governor's lounge was, and they didn't get to see anything but what was on television. They weren't allowed to leave. The servers and everything were not allowed to go in the main room. But here came Phyllis Schlafly, who they all knew, and got to take a picture with her up in the hallway.
Yeah, no, that's those stories. You know, in some ways, I guess, and we don't have to dwell on it too much. I think Phyllis was, she just lived a life that was so full of the kind of joy and family and all those things that you'd want, but also in terms of work. And once she got to a point where she was really sort of battling this respiratory and all, and it didn't take long in a way for her to go to her reward. It was a surprise in some ways to all of us. You know, just a few months ago, as you know, she was doing radio every day. She would do 3, 4, 5 video radio hits a day. And anyway, it is history will write, I must say, of Phyllis. Her longevity is extraordinary, 70 plus years in public life. But I think what will really become clear, and Andy Schlafly, I give him credit for the phrase, she transformed politics. She was like she was Shakespeare to American politics, like Shakespeare was to the English language. She took everything and turned it inside out and upside down and changed the way we do things. And it was in the written word, the communicated word, the policies, the understanding of the grassroots, understanding of the family, understanding the Constitution. She's one. One of a kind is a euphemism for what we had in her great life and what we'll have with her great legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, to find out on Labor Day that she had passed away, you could not imagine my shock because of the interviews we'd done, even at 92. But, Ed, one thing I do want to talk about is, before we get to the book, and I want to get to that next, but how was it that you became the successor to Mrs. Schlafly?
Well, that's a great question. I wish we could ask her, although she did. I will just tell you a little bit of a poignant story. I'll try not to choke up. In the last days of her life, I spent some time with her, and the last conversation I had, she patted my hand and she said, I'm so glad I found you. And that was a sort of classic phrase. You know, I come out of politics. I ran for office. Many people may not realize Phyllis ran for elected office twice, for Congress twice, lost both times, obviously. She also ran for national president of the Federated Women of America and lost. And she would tell people that those three experiences were formative because when you run and lose, when you run and win, you think you're a genius. You know, you just move on to being in office. When you run and lose, you sort of take to heart the lessons. And I think what Phyllis saw in me and what I would say is the Lord's providence of spinning me around, you know, my background is in law and ethics. I've, you know, spent some time overseas. But then I ran for office twice. And I came to work for her 3.5 years ago and spent a lot of time with her. And, you know, I agreed with her on the issues. I should tell you, kind of teasingly, I once said to her, I wasn't as convinced on free trade when I started. I didn't like free trade deals, but I wasn't sure how to think about it. And as I studied it with Phyllis, I became a total believer. But on her, how she thought about it. But the so I agreed on the issues, but then I also came to really recognize her incredible gift with people. And I think I have aspired to have some of that in terms of being able to communicate and understand. But mostly what Phyllis did was she wasn't a think tank, and she wasn't a political action committee. She was someone who straddled all those worlds and lived to make things better. And that's the challenge I take from her. What she said as she was in these last year and a half, when she told me things that she wanted to do, she said, I don't want you to become the Phyllis Schlafly think tank and say nice things about my writings. That's not enough. And I don't want you just to become a hired gun who does some conservative issues, you know, the organization. I want you to do what I've built and what I've done. And that's the challenge. It's going to be a real, I just told another interview, it's a terrible thing, I shouldn't do it, but it'll get some attention. He won't replace Phyllis Schlafly. There's no replacing her. It's going to take a village. it's going to take a village of people. You know, some are going to have to be writers and thinkers and doers and speakers, and some are going to be in fundraising and all these things. There's not going to be one person who can do what she did, but we can all put it together, honor what she did, and I think make things better.
Absolutely. The book is The Conservative Case for Trump. How did this book come about?
You know, that's a great thank you. People haven't asked me that question. The fact is that Phyllis wrote prolifically. So when Trump came down the escalator in June of last year, she started to write about what he was saying, and she was pretty impressed. You know, he had pivoted the whole Republican Party debate into trade and immigration, and so she wrote about it. She wrote radio commentaries, she wrote columns, she wrote a PS report, she wrote about it. And by the time we got to the fall, she'd written about 10 times total on these topics. By the time we got to the spring and she decided to endorse Trump, she had written probably more like 30 or 40 times. And so I turned to the publisher and I mentioned to him that we had all these writings of Phyllis. You know, could we publish it as a sort of, you know, a kind of a collection of Trumpisms? You know, actually the title I proposed was Permission to Trump, which was, I thought, a catchy way to say, describe. Phyllis had told a story in church one day, after church one day, two little old ladies that she knew, friends, came up to her and they whispered to her. They said, "Is it okay for us to be for Trump?" And so that was sort of the origin. Well, the publisher at Regnery, who published the book, said, "Yeah, collections like that don't work. Let's make it The Conservative Case for Trump." And his title, and we started working on it, Phyllis and I. And she's a brutal editor. She's so tough. She was so tough. She's such a great writer. And I was writing, she was tearing to pieces, and it was taking so long because we were both so busy that we added Brett, who is a writer and an editor, and that really kind of lit the fuse. And so we went in this modern era back and forth on emails, and we would write to each other. We'd write in the documents, and then we would print it out. Phyllis would go through it. Then we would all write again some chapters, and that's kind of how it came about. But really, maybe that's more detail than you wanted, but I will say that the key positioning was Phyllis wanted to make the case for Trump, not anti-Hillary, not, you know, don't pick the lesser two. But this is why conservatives can embrace Trump. It's 10 chapters, 10 pretty clear sort of positions on issues that I think people get, and that's what we were doing. It was a very Phyllis Schlafly-like thing to say, here's why we're for this guy and think he'll be great, not just why we're against the other guy or contrasting the other guy only.
When the campaign started a little over a year ago for Donald Trump, there were 17 Republicans, there were other business people, there were women, there were governors, there were former governors, there were senators, sitting senators. Why? What was it about him?
Well, you know, there are lots of things, and I think that it would be selling short Phyllis's analysis of who he was as a man and as a communicator and a leader. She thought all those things were impressive. But if you look at the book, there's a couple issues that are at the front of the book. I mean, that's chapter 1 and 2 that are important to Phyllis in a unique way, and I'm going to mention them in a second, but I do want to tell you a quick story your listeners may enjoy. Phyllis met with Trump on March 11th, and it was the only time they ever met face-to-face. And, you know, this past weekend, Trump came to the funeral, which was very kind of him, Phyllis's funeral. Extraordinary, really, and he and his wife were very kind. But on this day that they met, it's a Friday, March 11th, we met in a little room. I was with her, and she gave him a copy of the platform. And she said, "I've worked 50 years to get this platform great, the 2012 platform, and I need your help to keep it strong." And he said, "I'll help you." And it, by the way, at the convention in Cleveland, Phyllis has said the platform that came out of the 2016 convention was the best ever. And what we saw was that the Trump people honored their word, that on the major issues of conservatism, they were helping make the document even better. So, but the next thing that Phyllis brought up to Trump was, "I really need you to help me make sure, I really need you to promise me that we will, that you will appoint judges like Justice Scalia, who had died just a month before or so, a little earlier." And he said, "I will." And over the weeks after, we saw him talk about judges. We saw him take some of our suggestions. He listened, and that's a key issue. So that's all important, and I want to tell you that quick story. But, you know, the first two chapters in the book are about immigration and trade. And for Phyllis, her assessment over the last 5 years, 10 years, but especially the last five, was that the country is being transformed fundamentally by the issue of immigration and trade. And so when Trump seized on those and put them at the center of the debate and the conversation, Phyllis thought, as a matter of American survival, that this was the key cornerstone of the next period of time. I was on a TV show with a Hillary Clinton supporter, and I was talking about Trump's 10-point plan on immigration. And the guy said, well, Hillary's got a plan. I said, what is it? And he admitted it's amnesty. And Phyllis's point was, the culture is being changed by the immigration policies and failures, and the electoral landscape is being transformed too, and we've got to stop that. And then on trade, similar things. So that really became, and then she saw a guy that was talented. She would tell me, this guy is a talented, sometimes he comes across as more coarse than people would like. She would have acknowledged that. But his talent as connecting and being seen and understood as strong and leaderly was impressive to her.
One of the reasons I wanted to have Phyllis on, not just this new book coming out in the last 2 weeks, is something that I think does scare a few conservatives, Republicans, is that he tends to change his stance from time to time. Immigration was the big one a few weeks ago when he said he might soften, and then he said it's not going to happen immediately, and then he went to Mexico and came back and said they didn't talk about the wall, and the Mexican president said, yes, we did, and I told him I wasn't going to build it, and he said it was a negotiation. I think that is something that scares a lot of conservatives.
Yeah, I guess I can't. I want to put in words into Phyllis's mouth. I mean, I will say I asked her about that. I said, you know, how do you trust these people? You know, how do you? And she said, you do. You know, one of the things is you do a lot of listening, and you over the years you start a sense. I mean, I kind of, when we met with her afterwards, I said, you know, people might say that, can you trust Trump's word? And she said, well, my answer is I do. And, you know, meaning she didn't have to say the rest, which is, you know, you can either trust my judgment or not. And I used to joke with people that liked another candidate. I said, you know, Phyllis has been right, you know, pretty much for 70 years. I think she could be wrong this time, but I think I'm going to stick with it. But, you know, on some of those issues, Phyllis also is practical. You have to make progress. You have to move the ball down the court, and you have to get commitments. For example, Trump on abortion, his movement on pro-life, I think when I asked her about it and then we talked about it, you know, he seems like somebody who changed his position somewhat dramatically. And the way he talked about it and sounded about it and understood it and what he was willing to say about acting on it and judges was meaningful. On the plan, I also think Phyllis was, on immigration, Phyllis was also very practical. She taught me this. Politics is the art of winning the election. That doesn't mean you sell out. You shouldn't go against your... But, you know, I think what Trump did in that one day when he went to Mexico, looked presidential, and came back and laid out a 10-point plan. Point number 10 in that immigration plan, by the way, is lower legal immigration to historic lows. That's something Phyllis has been arguing for 20 years, and that's a real policy. E-Verify is in those top 10. That's a real policy. If you do E-Verify and you make it clear to people that you can't come and get jobs without a lot more effort and a lot more hiding, people are not going to come in the same way. So I don't worry so much about the politics of it. I think we have, you know, we are down to two people, and one of the other things Phyllis would love to say, I could hear her say it, is if you want a third party or fourth party or fifth party, go to Europe. We're a two-party system. Here we are. And in 2012 and 8 and other years, she backed the candidate who won the primary, even though it wasn't her choice. And so, you know, because the two-party system has to be sustained, that's what we have to make better. So I just think Phyllis's answer was she trusted him, and I think that's probably pretty good enough for me right now. And I think for a lot of people that read the book and think it through, they'll say that's going to be good enough. And I'll tell you another quick story she told me. Reagan nominated Sandra Day O'Connor, and Phyllis organized some of her Eagles to go and picket. And, of course, she backed Reagan to the hilt after that and before that. But the point is, these presidents aren't going to be perfect. We got to make them better and better. But when it comes to saving the direction of the country, I think Trump is the man.
That being said, if he does not get in, where do you feel this country goes?
Well, I don't like to be too dramatic about it, but I think, you know, President Obama has promised to transform America. He's done his best to do it, and I see nothing in Hillary Clinton that would change it. I think two or three or four justices to the Supreme Court, appointees to positions of influence in the Justice Department on religious liberty and things like that. I just think we're awfully close to a real transformation of our country. And I, again, on the key issues of trade and immigration, we maybe are further along than people realize. You know, if immigrants stop this sort of cultural and electoral transformation. We are losing our country. If the trade deals don't get better, we're transforming our nation, you know, and taking away so many family-supporting jobs. It's just transforming us. So I don't like to speculate, but it seems very grim if Hillary wins.
Why are these two candidates, somebody voted for them both because they're both there, but why do they both have the all-time lowest trustworthy poll numbers?
Well, I'm a little counterintuitive on this, to be frank. I think it's actually a product of the moment we're in our society. I think people are distrustful of anyone in positions of authority, even the sort of prospects. I'll never forget when I ran for office the first time, people would come up to me and they would say, you know, you're corrupt. I know, you're corrupt. You know, in other words, by running for office, you joined the corrupt class. You must be in for money. By the way, the flip side, people come up to you and say, you know, I've been waiting for you. You're gonna be the guy in Congress that's going to make everything. And you think to yourself, neither one of these people has the whole picture, right? I think a lot of folks right now are really down on the American system, and they take that out on anyone in public life. I think media, social media makes that possible. But I also think that's part of this time more than anything, you know, where we are. And, you know, it's we'll need a president. And by the way, I think another reason Trump, it's not in our book, but another reason Trump is the right choice, I think he's very talented. Maybe as talented as anybody we've seen in terms of communicating. I think he could win and unite us in ways that are different. And I think there's a real division amongst us right now. Seems like almost 50-50 will take sides of any issue, you know what it is. And so I think he has an opportunity. He's kind of got the courage, I think, to be that kind of leader if he's in office.
There were two chapters in the book I kind of want you to describe because I think they're two of the most interesting. Chapter number three, Political Correctness Kills. Now, kind of talk a little bit about that, because that has been seemingly one of the things that has hurt Donald Trump from time to time. He was pretty neck and neck with Hillary in the polls. He is now, but he was also pretty neck and neck with her before the Gold Star Family issue back in August, and that hurt him.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between being politically incorrect and making a mistake, and I think that was a mistake. I think maybe that what your point is, that this political correctness instinct is something that sometimes can get in the way of speaking truth. So look, I think you're here's what I think is so important. We have had a culture, both the media but also just the culture, that makes it so that you must sort of apologize or genuflect in the direction of the conventional wisdom as defined by them. And what we have is a guy that almost refuses to do that, even when he makes a mistake. I mean, I liked that a month ago he gave a speech where he talked about some contrition and some, you know, being sorry or apologetic for how things played out. I think that's helpful, because I don't think anybody is quite as much bravado as sometimes it appears. So, but political correctness, I mean, the culture, people almost, when they look up and they see somebody who's not going to take the cue from the mainstream media and the culture to apologize, it's like they can breathe deeply. They're so surprised. And when it comes to some of those issues that we talk about in there, about, for example, the ban on Muslims. It was not a ban on Muslims. It was a ban on Muslims, or it was a pause on Muslims until we figure out what exactly is going on. Most Americans look up and say, thank goodness. That's not bigotry. That's common sense, I think. You know, when it comes to sort of the global warming movement is another example is mentioned in there. You know, can we have somebody who says, you know, obviously we don't want to have, you know, waste and damage the environment and all, but we also are falling for this sort of academic games that are told. So, and Trump is refreshing in that sense. And I think, again, you pointed out, sometimes he goes too far. Sometimes he makes a statement that you think, yeah, I think that was not politically incorrect, that just was incorrect. But in general, it's so different than what we have seen that it's like a breath of fresh air.
It's interesting because you talk about that party platform, and one thing that I think was a little unexpected when we go, and speaking of him speaking off the cuff and political correctness, at the Republican convention, which Phyllis was at and I was at and we all were there, Trump slipped something into his speech that had never really been spoken about at a Republican convention, and that was the LGBT community. I asked Phyllis about that when she appeared on this program in early August, just about a month ago, and so let's go back and listen to that. The late Phyllis Schlafly on this program, talking about Donald Trump and the LGBT comment at the Republican National Convention. One thing that was different about Donald Trump's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, which I know you were there for, was that he talked...
It was a great speech.
And you enjoyed the speech. Was the support of the LGBT community, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, said he would protect them. What did you make of that? First time that ever happened at a Republican convention.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I heard that. I must have turned down my hearing aid and that happened.
Yeah. Well, he now knowing that he said it, what do you feel about it?
Well, I'm a bit surprised, but, you know, candidates, when they're nominated, are trying to please everybody. And he's not perfect, I can tell you. I knew when I supported Ronald Reagan in 1980 that he was not perfect.
The late Phyllis Schlafly on this show in the beginning of August. What do you make of that comment, Ed?
Well, there's two things I'd say. Is I talked to her. I didn't realize that interview. I'm not sure if she was tracking perhaps that question up, because I think what we talked about was it is refreshing to have a candidate who says, for example, you know, ideologies that want to throw you know, gay people off a rooftop and kill them, like some of the radical Islam. That's refreshing to have somebody be more supportive of everyone, you know, whether you're black, white, whatever the thing is. I think that was one of the things I took away. But I think it's very important what you said. People got to read this book and understand. You know, Phyllis Schlafly told me about Reagan. She said, we didn't know that Reagan was conservative on some things. You know, he had signed an abortion law in California as governor in the late 60s. He'd signed the most kind of expansive civil divorce law, no-fault divorce law in California, which pro-family advocates were appalled by and really led the country in making divorce sort of something you can do between, lunch and dinner. And it's terrible stuff. So she said, we worried about him. We worried about Nancy, who had positions that just sounded liberal. And she said, so we worried about him. And she said, in some ways, he let us down on some fundamental issues, taxes, amnesty, a few things. But she said, at the time we were looking for Reagan, we had Carter, who was appearing, and Kissinger, were appearing to lose the Cold War to the Soviets. And they didn't understand, the country didn't understand the threat, or maybe they did, but they were being led by people that didn't. So Reagan was transformative because he was strong. He knew that communism was evil, and he knew the Soviet Empire was the evil empire. And she said the military became stronger because of him. She said he was the guy for that job. And with Trump, the fundamental, again, chapters 1 and 2, is the transformation on immigration and trade, the transformation of our country, and our the diminishing of American sovereignty is what Phyllis said. If we don't have someone addressed now, we're not going to be able to debate whether No Child Left Behind was a disaster or Common Core is a disaster, which she thought both things. The question becomes, we won't be here, is that we will never win another election, and our culture will continue down a path. So sometimes you get the right man for the job, and, you know, it's not... Phyllis was clear. She's a woman of faith. The kingdom will come someday, and then perfection will reign. But for now, we're going to do the best we can with the folks we have. And by the way, one last thing. Phyllis believed Trump could win. She thinks he's a charismatic kind of character, and I think we're seeing some of that in these recent days and polls.
Was there ever, to your speculation, a political presidential nominee for the Republican Party that Phyllis, even though she supported him, was not really hot on?
Well, I'll tell you it differently. Not really, in the sense that she believed in the Republican Party, and so when you had to contrast the two, she was for them. But I will tell you, she was a very practical lady. 2.5-3 years ago, we released the updated Choice Not an Echo, which the Choice Not an Echo, the original in 64, was a telling of how the Kingmakers dominated Republican politics, and she recounted it by going from the 52, 56, 60 conventions and talking about what was going on. The updated version, which came out a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, it went all the way up to the 2012 convention and told the stories. So it was really a historical narrative. She told me once that she had written that book and updated it through 2000 election, and but she didn't put it out before the 2004 because she believed that Bush needed to win re-election, and she thought some of the machinations would be distracting to his win. In other words, she was a practical lady, too. She was looking at it saying, okay, we've got to help make progress. And she didn't spend a lot of time running down people by saying so-and-so was not the best nominee. I mean, after the fact, when they lost, she would certainly be critical of candidates who didn't do well. But it wasn't a kind of dissatisfaction. It was a wanting to win and make progress for the issues she believed in.
She had told me once that she had never supported a Democrat, and during our last interview in early August, speaking of this election with Trump and Hillary, I felt this was a funny and an interesting moment from that interview. Phyllis Schlafly on this show early August 2016. What do you make of the current political scene in this country?
Well, if the people ask me why I endorse Trump, I say read The Choice Not an Echo, and you'll see that I've spent my whole life trying to kill the advantage and machinations of the kingmakers, because it's a bunch of rich people. You know, I think that Citizens United speech was very bad. It allowed rich people to put so much money, their own money, it's true. But I think it was not good for politics.
You know, that's...
And, I don't think we should have so much money floating around in politics.
It's interesting because you bring up Citizens United, and that was actually something that Hillary Clinton talked about in her acceptance speech last week. So you agree with Secretary Clinton on overturning Citizens United?
It may be the only thing we agree on.
That might be right. I enjoyed that moment, Ed.
Yeah, well, she's funny. You know, it was true. She was always for the little guy, and little gal, I guess, too. And she thought that the campaign finance, some of the rules that allowed such massive amounts of money and from, you know, corporations and things that were not transparent was really a distorting effect. She certainly thought that there was free speech and should be asserted, but she was clear on that and always was. You know, I'll just tell one quick story that relates to that, because Phyllis was always a very strong proponent, as a matter of our policy, on patents, and especially protecting the little guy. America was built on our patent system. You could invent something and you'd have it protected. In other places, they just steal it from you. The government does, like China right now. And one time I asked her about that, and she told me a long story, which I didn't understand until she finished, that it was in large part formed by her impression as a young girl when her father, who lost his job in the Depression and then got other jobs and was sort of working different jobs, would come home every night, and he invented an engine, a rotary engine that was later used by Mazda, and he got a patent. It never came of much in his own life. But she said that she saw someone work and want to claim that and the patent process. And she came from very little. She came from very humble beginnings. So she had a real sense of the underdog. And, you know, when Donald Trump came to the funeral, he mentioned in his comments, he was very, very well-done comments, very understated, respectful of the funeral. And he talked about that Phyllis was on the side of the underdog and the side of the little guy. And she did that. She lived that, and she came from that perspective.
Something else in the book, and again, the book is The Conservative Case for Trump. You will want to get a copy of this. A chapter that I found very interesting, Trump or a New Constitutional Convention. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, this was something that was a focus of Phyllis's for a long time. Phyllis had been writing for 30 or 40 years about the question of the Constitution and efforts to change it. Now, Phyllis was on the Bicentennial Commission for the Constitution. It was chaired by retired Chief Justice Berger, and she loved that. She thought she had grown in such devotion to the Constitution over her life, and that was in the 80s. Reagan appointed her, and she loved that, and she loved promoting it. And she started writing about the movement by some to, so, quote-unquote, improve the Constitution. And while there has certainly been a need over time to amend the Constitution, you know, to change, you know, women's suffrage and other things, Phyllis recognized that some of the movements could allow a runaway convention. And, you know, and that notion, the so-called Article 5, the way that you could have a convention of states, sometimes it's called, and others, it's been called different things over the years, but Phyllis really objected to that. She subscribed to what Justice Scalia said a few years ago, maybe a year ago, actually, where he said it's the wrong century to hold any kind of convention. I'm paraphrasing, to be honest, but it's something like that. And Phyllis's point was, people are so fed up with how poorly things are working. In that chapter of the book, when we write about that, we say they're getting desperate because they've tried to throw the bums out in 2010, or at least put in the new guys, and then new guys didn't do much. They tried to get rid of the president in 2012, and they lost, and he stayed in and did his thing. They tried to give a Republican Senate, and they expected him to stand up and fight back, and they didn't do much. And her point was, we're building towards such frustration that people will try to do anything to fix it, including a constitutional convention, which would be a disaster because it would get out of control. I mean, I love the quote, there's not a lot of Ben Franklins around America right now, but there are a number of Barney Franks. You know, Nancy Pelosi would be picking delegates to a constitutional convention. She'd probably be one. This is a problem. And so that's why Phyllis wrote that. She said she thinks Trump can turn the country, give us a focus, and take us away from these well-intentioned people who are so frustrated by what's going on that they're grasping at what they think is a last straw of a constitutional convention.
You know, when Phyllis died on Labor Day, and having talked with her so much, and certainly actually in regard to this book, The Conservative Case for Trump, something that popped in my mind the immediate moment that I heard that she had passed away, and I even wrote a little article on it, was when we spoke, and I don't have the audio clip of this, but when we spoke the last time, I believe it is on the website, though, wwgh1071.com in the archives. It's the Phyllis Schlafly interview from August. I asked her if she took any pride at all, even though she didn't agree with Hillary Clinton at all, in regard to Hillary being the first female nominated by one of the two major political parties. And she said no. And when she passed away, what struck me was, even though outside of Citizens United, it's very clear they did not agree on anything, there are a lot of similarities between the two outside of the political world. They obviously, number one, and obviously, they both were women. They both were in the law field. They both never spent time on dependent systems like welfare. Both of them started businesses. Both are organizations, nonprofit organizations. Both of them were players majorly in this political system on both sides. So, you know, even though Phyllis obviously did not like Hillary, had no machinations to vote for her or agree with her on anything, it was women like Phyllis Schlafly, and also on the Democratic side, like I would say Gloria Steinem, who did not stay at home, who did pave the way, in a way, for people like Hillary Clinton.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a sort of a longer question. Here's what I would say is Phyllis loved to say about this topic that she had it all, just not all at once. And in other words, she was a mother and a wife. She loved talking about her husband. She was a wife in a very wonderful way. Her whole life while her husband was alive, she had children. She, you know, taught her kids to read. She led organizations, ran for office, just not at once. And I think what she would say was the feminists don't really want the liberation of women. They want to transform how we live. And so she never accepted their notion, their euphemism that we're liberating women. You know, and I think that would be how she would sort of characterize it, that Hillary Clinton as a person, you know, has every right to what she wants to do, but the culture is transforming and making it difficult for people to do what is, in Phyllis's mind, the best way to build flourishing communities, which is to have families with a mother and father, a husband and wife that have children and move. It doesn't mean that there's not divorce and single moms and all. Phyllis had a great, support, affection for all the different people can be widowed or, become widowers. It's a lot of things. But in general, that's the goal, the ideal. And the feminists, she never bought their notion that they really were into liberating. She thought that they were transforming how people lived in a negative way.
Is it, and certainly Phyllis was not a feminist, but just there are some parallels there. But the conservative case for Trump, the book, the guest today is Ed Martin. We have about 4 minutes left, and there are two questions I want to get in. The things Trump says about women, and he has said them, and as Phyllis said, he's not perfect. That's not Ronald Reagan, not perfect. That's different. Is that okay?
What do you mean that's not... say that again.
I don't think Ronald Reagan would call women fat or degenerate or pigs. Ronald Reagan was known as calling his wife mommy and opening the door and writing her love letters, and I can't...
Didn't he say that about Rosie O'Donnell, and he said it sort of with a joking thing? I mean, look, I think...
But Megyn Kelly as well. Megyn Kelly at Fox.
I certainly don't think people should be, and I think Phyllis would agree, should be disrespectful to each other, and so there's no doubt, again, I don't think we're putting out that Reagan is, that Trump is Reagan either automatically. What we're saying is at a key moment in the transformation of America, Reagan stepped up to save America's future, and a key moment in the history of America, Phyllis Schlafly's assessment is that Trump is the guy that can stand up and do that. Does it mean that everything's going to be perfect? Of course not. Does it mean everything is going to be done the way Phyllis would have done it? No way. I mean, Phyllis was an incredibly gifted arguer, debater who did it with style. One of the feminists said that they used to draw straws to see who had to debate her because they hated it, because no matter what you did, you just ended up looking bad. So she was special, but we're going to deal with who we've got to deal with. And if, again, in our book, The Conservative Case for Trump, you'll see on issues how conservatives can be comfortable. And by the way, we do write on family. And I know people say, well, he's twice divorced and all. Well, a lot of people are twice divorced and divorced in the country and the culture. We're looking at how he talks about his family now, how he relates to his kids, that he doesn't drink alcohol, never has. There's things about him that give you a sense of the man. I'm not saying, neither would Phyllis, that he is somehow saintly, but I think that you get an impression of the person that is serious and important and worth kind of recognizing.
In the end, the end result of this comes up to be in less than 50 days, we are going to choose one of these two people, Trump or Clinton. People can vote any which way they want to. You obviously have this book praising Trump. But if, is there anything Trump could do, because he is so unpredictable, that would put you off?
I'm kind of immune to campaigns. In the sense that speculating on what he could do or say or could happen, I just think what I'm focused on is saying to other conservatives, look at this book and these issues and think that through. Because to cast your vote or stay at home, cast your vote somewhere else or stay at home has real impacts. But I don't know. I just don't. I'm not very good at game to figure out what could be that bad or not. I think we've got 55 days or whatever. We're going to get there soon enough and have an answer.
With 1 minute left, this is a big pass to throw. And again, I do want to let people know the book is The Conservative Case for Trump. Phyllis Schlafly, Ed Martin, and Brett Decker, the authors of this, the late Phyllis Schlafly. When Phyllis passed away, I even talked about this with Andy the following day. She had cakes thrown in her face. People, there was a group that really did not like her, and I was even shocked when she died at some of the articles that were written, really hated her. People really either like Trump or they really hate him. Is that ever justified? Is it justified to hate Hillary Clinton? Is it ever justified to hate a person?
Well, I guess my better way to answer, the short answer seems to me is no. I mean, you've got to take a step back. But I'd rather tell you and kind of remind myself and you, I'm sure, you know, Phyllis had this incredible instinct to argue hard, to make arguments with lots of facts, but to never let it be personal. And she told me that. She said, it's never personal. You know, it's not, you know, one time I had said something about John Boehner failing, and I said this or that, and she said, hey, wait a second. It's never personal. And I think if it becomes personal, like people are, it's a real failure. So I do think that's something that Phyllis just, but it's very hard. We're in a coarse time where people want to feel and say what they think. Somehow I think, you know, Facebook and social media and others, you things that you should maybe think and then have a time to process, you put out on Facebook, and you get into the habit of expressing yourself before you think, you know. And but in politics, I think Phyllis would have encouraged us to fight like we're in charge, but recognize that God's in charge. I think I read she said that in an interview that I was reading recently. So it's and part of that is because you recognize the human beings around you, no matter what party, as gifts from God that is special. So
short yes or no answer on that. Whoever's elected on November the 8th, on November the 9th, should we support them?
Well, I think that I've always thought that, yeah. I mean, we have to be respectful of who the people choose and begin to work. If there's someone you disagree with, work with the Republican Congress, the House and Senate, so you bet.
The conservative case for Trump, our guest today, has been Ed Martin, Phyllis Schlafly's personal successor at the Eagle Forum. This has been fun, Ed. I hope you come back in the future.
I would like that very much. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we're going to come back in about 15 minutes with Representative Ted Deutsch from Florida. 15 minutes and then open phone lines for the last half hour. You're not going to want to miss that.
Be a cake, but it is.
WWGH